For the next couple hours, we're going to talk about a secret space program. We're going to talk about UFOs. We're going to talk about the life of William Tompkins. William passed away on the solar eclipse day on August 21st. In addition to his work for decades with the U.S. Navy, leading aerospace corporations and Navy support organizations, he decided to cap his remarkable life with his insider testimony about what he said was the Navy's secret space program. And then back in 2015, he wrote a book called Selected by Extraterrestrials, and he simply electrified the UFO exopolitics community with his testimony about the Navy's development of space battle groups. It's an amazing story. One of his proponents, of course, Michael Sala. Michael was on with me some time ago as we talked about the life of William Tompkins before he died and about his work and research. Michael is with us next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Dr. Michael Sala back with us. He's a pioneer in the development of exopolitics, author of Exposing U.S. Government Policies on Extraterrestrial Life and Exopolitics as well. He was an assistant professor, researcher in residence in the School of the International Service of the American University. He has a PhD in government from the University of Queensland, Australia, and founder of the Exopolitics Institute, which is a not-for-profit organization which analyzes the political implications of extraterrestrial life. And Michael, thank you for coming on to talk about the life of William Tompkins. I really appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome, George. I'm glad to be back here.
He was quite the pioneer talking about the Navy's secret space program. What got him to go public with this?
Well, he has led a really exceptional life. I mean, as a 17-year-old, because of his precocious abilities, he was recognized by senior Navy officials as someone that they wanted to recruit into the Navy. I mean, there's documents that show that admirals were actually meeting with him and communicating with him and introduced him at a very early stage into the Navy intelligence, and they trained him when he was only 17 years old in advanced aircraft research. He began working with the Volte Aircraft Company in 1940 when he was 17, and he just went through a long career in understanding various aspects about advanced aircraft design and propulsion systems and navigation and all of the things that are required for aircraft. And so after he finished his Navy career, he then went and worked with the Douglas Aircraft Company, which again was at the cutting edge of advanced aircraft development. And that's when he got to be helped by these Nordic extraterrestrials, as he describes them in his book, in designing these huge battle craft that would be flying deep in space, forming space carrier groups that later on Gary McKinnon talked about fleet-to-fleet transfers. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, Bill Tompkins, he was describing, you know, exactly what was happening.
We had a chance to have Bill on the program with our investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe a few years ago, and of course you've known Bill for a number of years. Was his death sudden and unexpected, Michael, or was it expected?
Definitely unexpected. I mean, he was in good health. I just saw him. The last time I saw him was at the MUFON conference in Las Vegas. We actually had dinner with his wife and my wife, and he was in excellent health, excellent spirits. And Dr. Bob Wood, he actually met with Bill on Friday, last Friday, and they discussed the second volume of his book, and were kind of like going over some research for it. And then on Saturday, Bob learned that Bill had fallen. He had fallen twice, and that he had hit his head apparently, and had caused some kind of blood tumor. He was taken to the Scripps Hospital. And the doctors there said that this blood tumor was inoperable. They had him on life support, and sometimes Sunday evening they pulled him off life support, and so the family were there, and then he died 2:30 a.m. on Monday, the day of the full solar eclipse. So, yes, it caught all of us by surprise because he really was in excellent health and good spirits.
That's sad.
But he has had a recent history of falling, you know, and so that's why, you know, people say, well, you know, was this, you know, was this somehow contrived? Well, you know, I guess, you know, anything can be kind of like moved along by those with the technologies to do it. But, you know, Bill did have, you know, a recent history of, you know, slipping and falling and hurting himself. He broke his wrist a few months ago, you know, after a fall. So, you know, it's more likely than not that it was just a natural process.
Sure.
He's 94 years old, and he just didn't have as good balance as he used to have.
Sadly, 94, we've lost him, but that's a pretty good run, isn't it? 94 years old, it's pretty good.
It is. You know, especially as he, you know, right throughout his life, he always distinguished himself. And even in retirement, I mean, he distinguished himself. Actually, it's hard to say that Bill retired because he never really retired from the Navy. You know, one of the things that he confided to Dr. Bob Wood and myself, I'm not sure how many others he told, but he never really was fully retired. He was still active Navy. He had a rank, and he was assigned to basically be a consultant for the Navy, and he attended these Navy West meetings every year since the year 2000 up until 2017. He attended, and he was admitted with a rank, and his rank was Lieutenant Commander. So this was something that he had instructed us while he was alive never to reveal, but I'm able to say it now that he was. Ever since he worked at Naval Air Station San Diego, he was given a covert rank of Lieutenant Commander. So, you know, and that was it was job specific. I mean, this was one of the things I discovered in my research that, you know, during the Second World War, when Bill was working at the research and development for the Naval Air Station in San Diego, you know, his normal job was a second machinist mate. So, you know, he was just a junior enlisted officer.
Yeah, enlisted
personnel. But he had a covert assignment as a disseminator of naval aircraft research and development. And that covert assignment carried with it a rank of lieutenant commander. And he carried that right through his life. And he actually showed us the passes that he had to enter.
I bet he was proud of that, too.
That was definitely, we had a lot of research documents that showed that he was part of a covert program at Naval Air Station. But, you know, more recently when he was going to these Navy West meetings in San Diego, that he was given entrance with a pass where his rank was Lieutenant Commander.
What did his Navy veterans think of him and the things that he said, which we'll get into, about the secret space program and extraterrestrials?
Right. Well, you know, I spoke to four Navy officers in doing my research on Bill Tompkins. Three of them were colleagues or people that worked with him at the Navy League in Medford, Oregon, which he started up around the year 1991, right up until the year 2000, that he actually was the president of that. And you know, one was a captain. That was Captain Bowick, and then there was a commander, and one other officer whose name escapes me at the moment. But all three basically identified him as someone that was well respected within the Navy, that he had knowledge about extraterrestrial life, that he was considered to be an expert in that, and that he was also running these special projects. And Bill had supplied documents showing special projects as an item on an agenda that, you know, the minutes of a meeting. There were several meetings where, you know, you have special projects actually listed as an item of discussion. And on one of the slides that we got from Bill, you know, it mentioned mentioned one of the special projects as basically being a galactic command communications and control center, that basically he was training the children of Navy officials to learn all about the galaxy, and that you know, these Navy personnel, mainly retired, who are either with the Navy League in Medford or with the Navy Reserves in Medford, that they attended these meetings, and that Bill actually had been given equipment from the Naval Air Station in Miramar in that San Diego area. So he had been given communication systems that he used for this covert training in Medford. So he was a man that was highly respected by Navy officers, retired Navy officers, and actually a serving Rear Admiral, that was Admiral Larry Marsh, traveled from Seattle. I mean, at the time, he was the head of the Seattle Naval Shipyards and ran the submarine facility there, Bangor, Bangor 6, I believe, in Seattle or near Seattle, and that he actually traveled to Medford, Oregon in 1991 to actually open the Navy League chapter. And when I spoke to Admiral Marsh, he actually said that Bill Tompkins was very highly regarded by the Navy for all his work for the Navy over the years. He was very knowledgeable on a number of topics of interest to the Navy. And, you know, what I found very intriguing was that he said that he went down to Medford to open this because it was very important for the Navy. So, you know, here you have a serving Navy admiral leading a very important post, you know, where he's running two commands, to travel down to Medford to open up this kind of nominally private Navy League Council in Medford, Oregon. So, and Bill was the president of that right up until the year 2000.
Was that Admiral Larry Marsh? Was that who that was?
Correct, yes, Admiral Larry Marsh. And there's a photo of Admiral Marsh with Bill Tompkins taken at the opening of the Medford Navy League Council. And, you know, there it shows that quite clearly that the Admiral had made this journey down there to open up this Navy League chapter. So, you know, Bill Tompkins was highly regarded right up until the, right throughout the years by Navy, senior Navy personnel. And in the back of his book, Selected by Extraterrestrials, there's an excerpt there where he refers to an Admiral Hugh Webster, who actually that Bill cites as giving Bill the go-ahead to reveal everything he knew. Because Bill was a Navy man, you know, through and through. I mean, he always followed orders.
Sure.
And in 2001, Admiral Webster gave Bill the go-ahead. You know, tell it all, Bill. I mean, that's
he turned him loose, basically.
He did turn him loose, exactly. And so it took Bill a long time. I mean, even though in 2001 he got the go-ahead, it was only in 2009, I believe, that he met with Dr. Wood and then he got that help in editing the book that eventually emerged in December of 2015. And you know, that's not that long ago. It's only it's less than 2 years. But you know, since that book came out, it really has really galvanized the exopolitical and the UFO community, just because of the extensive revelations he has in there about secret space programs, and some of it really dovetails with the testimony of Corey Good and some of the other people have come forward saying that they're part of 20 and back space program.
Mm-hmm.
So he was a very important person because he was so well regarded and credentialed, and he had many documents. And I did do a number of Freedom of Information Act requests and approached the National Archives and got more documents about Bill, just confirming many of the things that he was saying.
What did he say specifically about the secret space program? Was it involved in trying to shoot down extraterrestrials, or was it a joint venture? What was it?
Well, basically, he described the role he played in the evolution of the secret space program. He says that while he was at Douglas Aircraft Company, he was being helped by a group of three Nordic or human-looking extraterrestrials that had infiltrated the company, and that they would help him telepathically come up with the designs for complex battle groups or complex space craft that would be part of these battle groups. And so Bill said that he would get this assistance. I mean, he was himself a brilliant designer, but as he kind of went through the design process for the various craft that would be part of these battle groups, whenever he said that whenever he hit a problem and couldn't resolve it, he would be helped telepathically by one of these Nordics that had infiltrated Douglas.
Wow.
So eventually, he would come up with these designs, and then they would pass on these designs to the proper people in Navy intelligence in the form of an unsolicited bid, and then the Navy would then take it up, up to architects and so forth to have the kind of more complex engineering architectural plans developed that would eventually lead to them being assembled in secret facilities in the Wasatch Mountains of Utah.
Michael, why is a secret space program secret? What are they trying to hide?
Well, I think it's national security from the very beginning in terms of firstly, the existence of extraterrestrial life. That was not something that the military, the national security system, wanted the American public to know, nor did they want the American public to know that a substantial number of Germans from Nazi Germany had relocated to Antarctica and developed a German space program in Antarctica that by the end of the 1940s was actually sending craft, which, still sounds amazing for many kind of like who are just locked into the more conventional historical view of space exploration, that the Germans in the mid-40s and late 40s were sending craft to the moon, Mars, and the planets of the outer part of the solar system. This is something that Bill Tompkins says that he learned through these Navy spies, but this was all very sensitive information because one of the things that the American and the world public believed was that Germany had been comprehensively defeated, that it was unconditional surrender, but in fact it wasn't. That the Germans had relocated successfully enough of their personnel and advanced research facilities to Antarctica to continue to operate long after the war, and eventually become so powerful that they had to they were able to force the United States into secret agreements.
Huh. And do you think that Wernher von Braun, for example, knew what was going on at Antarctica?
Definitely, Wernher von Braun and many other of the former Nazi German scientists that were part of the NASA program. I'm thinking about Dr. Kurt Debus, who was also the first director of the Kennedy Space Center. They knew what was going on in Antarctica, but von Braun and Debus and others that were part of the rocket program, this was a technology that was kind of like considered to be second tier.
All right, hold on, Michael. We're at the break. We'll come back and talk more about this. Plus, you know something about the Vatican and extraterrestrials. We'll talk about that, too. Welcome back to Coast to Coast, Dr. Michael Sala. We're talking about, of course, the secret space program and also the life of William Tompkins, who wrote a book called Selected by Extraterrestrials. Tell me your thoughts about the Vatican, Michael. We've talked about this before, but you think they're truly on the verge of some historic announcement, don't you?
Definitely. If you look at recent history of the Vatican when it comes to the topic of extraterrestrial life, you can see that from the year 2008, which is the year that there were rumors, unconfirmed rumors, that the United Nations had been having secret meetings to discuss a plan for revealing the existence of extraterrestrial life, and that the Vatican had played a prominent role in that, that from 2008 you have a Catholic priest, a Jesuit, Father Funes, Gabriel Funes, who was the head of the Vatican's astronomy department there.
And there are two observatories, right?
That's right. They had the observatory in Mount Graham as well. And he basically did an interview for the one of the Vatican's newspapers called the L'Osservatore Romano, where he actually described extraterrestrials as being more ethically evolved, that they would be more ethically evolved than humanity, that they could well be our brothers, and that they could be baptized. And so then you had the Vatican authorizing at least two major astrobiology conferences. You have other Jesuit astronomers, such as Brother Guy Consolmagno, writing a book and being very prominent in international meetings about extraterrestrials being baptized, that they would be more ethically evolved, but not. But basically, the way in which the Catholic theological position has evolved or positioned itself as regarding extraterrestrials is that extraterrestrials are more ethically evolved than humans, but less evolved than angels. Which means that the Christian message, because the foundation of it is the life of and death of Jesus Christ and the resurrection, of course, then the message and the relevance of Jesus would be something of relevance to the extraterrestrials. And then again, you know, what the extraterrestrials know about human history would be relevant to the Catholic Church. So, you know, what has happened is that the Catholic Church, under Pope Benedict and now Pope Francis, has evolved in terms of how extraterrestrials are viewed under Catholic theology, whereby extraterrestrials can be accepted as beings that can augment the Catholic view of the universe, but at the same time, extraterrestrials can benefit in terms of what the Catholics have to say or Christians have to say about the life and resurrection of Jesus. So the Catholic Church has really positioned itself to make a major announcement concerning extraterrestrial life, and this is something that, according to Corey Good, who I'm sure many of the listeners have heard, has been saying that he's been given briefings by a number of insiders, and that he's been told, according to his sources, that the Vatican actually is ready to reveal the existence of a group of human-looking extraterrestrials, and that they would kind of like help humanity enter into a new galactic age.
How do you think they'll make that announcement, Michael? I mean, will the Pope be flanked by an ET? What do you think it'll be?
Well, you know, I think very recently there was a friendship statement where the Pope was joined by the Dalai Lama and around 20 other prominent religious figures from the Muslim world, the Buddhist world, Shintoism, Confucianism, all these different groups, and that they all participated in an online statement that was released on YouTube and also in written form, where they called for all the religions of the world to basically develop friendship and unity. And so I think what's likely to happen is that there's going to be some event whereby the Pope and probably a couple of other prominent religious leaders together are going to emerge with a human-looking extraterrestrial and say that this is a being from the stars who is here to help us move into a new galactic age of awareness, that we're not alone and that there are incredibly advanced technologies and also spiritual philosophies to be shared and by humanity and these extraterrestrials.
Michael, the secret space program, of course, is hidden, but we're getting things public now. Is there, the Congress proposed an Air Force Space Corps. What's that all about?
Well, yes, that's a really interesting issue, George. I mean, we know that there was a lot of controversy over that it was proposed by a congressional committee that the U.S. Air Force develop a space corps, but it was something that the Air Force itself opposed and the Pentagon also opposed. So, you know, it's quite confusing. Why would Congress, which often defers to the military, especially when it comes to expenditure, instruct the Air Force to put together, assemble a space corps when the Air Force was opposed to it? So, you know, there's something quite kind of fishy there, and you know, I can guess that essentially it was done to kind of like in a way get people to think about the possibility that there is a space corps in operation, or that this is something that is in the pipeline, but kind of like muddy the waters because you know, there is, as a number of whistleblowers or insiders have said, that there is actually a space corps that's been in operation since the 1950s, and that it's actually under the auspices of the Navy, and in particular run by the U.S. Marine Corps.
What kind of craft do you think they're using?
I think that the craft that they would be using and the technologies that they would be using for being able to move vast distances through space from planet to planet and so forth, you know, would be a combination of some kind of craft that uses space-time technologies, you know, typically some sort of torsion field technology, whereby if plasma is rotated at the very high speeds and at high pressures, it generates a space-time effect. So, you know, time can dilate within the apparatus where you have this spinning plasma, and it is basically able to move very quickly through space through whatever propulsion system it has. And because time is dilated, you know, within the craft, it means that they can move vast distances at what appears to be kind of like only a moment for them, and basically, you know, they can go anywhere in the galaxy and then come back, because they're able to actually not only slow time down but also reverse time. You know, this is because they're able to kind of travel at faster than light. And so there is a kind of a time regression as well in operation. So this is something that these craft are able to do. And also they use portal technology as well, that there are both artificial and natural portals, or stargates as it's popularly known, where people and equipment can be moved from, you know, one part of the planet to other parts of the planet, or to other planets. So, you know, there's a number of ways in which people can be transported and equipment moved with the secret space programs.
In talking about other planets, what do you think's going on Mars? Andrew Basiago, for example, has said on this program many times that he was teleported to Mars as a youngster. Seems like a far-out story, Michael.
Well, you know, this is one of the things, you know, when you have a number of people coming forward and saying very similar things. I mean, Andy Basiago has had other people, three other people so far, who have come forward to say that, you know, they were part of that same program, the Mars Jumpgate, from 1980 to 83, as I recall it. And then you have the great-granddaughter of President Eisenhower, Laura Eisenhower, saying that she was actually approached to go to Mars. And then you have these more recent whistleblowers who say that they were part of these 20 and back programs, and that they traveled to Mars as part of those programs. And very recently, we had Robert David Steele. I don't know if you've interviewed him yet, but he actually said that they were taking people to Mars, actually children, that many of the children that disappear, that they end up on Mars as slave labor. So you know, there's quite a pool now of testimonies from independent sources saying that, you know, there are bases on Mars that have been built by these secret space programs, and that they are able to kind of like extract people, sometimes under kind of false pretenses, and abuse them as slave labor.
What do you think of the story? I mean, it seems far-fetched, doesn't it?
Well, what I always do is to kind of listen to what these different sources have to say and compare them and see if there are points of similarity, see if they've kind of like contaminated one another's testimonies, and also to kind of look at real-life events. And one of the things that really convinced me that, you know, things that this kind of slave labor is occurring on Mars bases is two real-life events that occurred in 2016 that kind of dovetailed with this information first emerging into the public arena under Corey Good, at least, in the middle of 2016. First, there was a meeting by the British Interplanetary Society in June of 2016, where the meeting basically discussed the scenario of how to remove a Mars colony dictator who abused workers. Right there you have the British Interplanetary Society discussing the very scenario that Corey Good at the time was saying was occurring on Mars. And at the same time, again, you had the US Congress proposing legislation to give immunity to corporations that were involved in space mining up until the year 2022. And this legislation was signed by President Obama in October of 2016. And essentially the legislation did give protection under the US legal code to any corporation that submitted to US jurisdiction when it came to space affairs, that no regulations, no kind of laws or international treaties would apply to these companies' operations in space up until 2022, which effectively meant that, you know, if what Corey Good and others are saying, that there was slave labor on Mars, that under this legislation that was passed by the Congress and signed by Obama, none of the companies involved in these kinds of abuses, none of the officials could be prosecuted because they could just recognize U.S. Jurisdiction over their activities and say that, well, under the space mining law, they have immunity up until 2022.
Why is Antarctica so important to this big picture?
Well, Antarctica is really the big mystery here, because that's the place where the German space program was able to relocate during the war. And one of the things that I'm currently researching is the different German corporations that were involved in building the initial space prototypes or spacecraft prototypes that were used by the Germans, like the Hannibal craft. There are a number of German companies that were involved in this. For example, the Hannibal 2 craft that was built by the Dornier company, the Siemens company, and AEG, other German companies, were involved in building the propulsion systems for these craft. And so these German companies actually relocated substantial resources to Antarctica as part of a directive that was passed by Martin Bormann in 1944 at a meeting in Strasbourg, where German companies were instructed to get all of their assets, all of their liquid assets and other resources out of Germany because the war was lost. Now the Germans were in a holding action. And so, you know, they went down to Antarctica. And what I've found is that essentially after Operation High Jump, where Admiral Byrd's task force in 1946-47 was basically intercepted and defeated by these Nazi flying saucers out of Antarctica, that the Germans were able to move ahead and make Antarctica the secret base of operations, you know, not only for space colonization, but also for a covert takeover of the planet and establishing a Fourth Reich, whereby the Germans in Antarctica would exercise incredible influence over other nations of the world, especially the European Union and the United States, where secret agreements were reached. And so in the middle of the 1950s, you have a lot of U.S. companies and European companies beginning to work with the German companies that were in Antarctica. And this all coincided with the International Geophysical Year. And so in the mid-50s, there was an incredible surge of activity in Antarctica after agreements had been reached between the Eisenhower administration and the Germans.
You don't think there's a big spaceship hidden under there, Michael?
You know, that's one of the other things about Antarctica, that you know, there are a number of anomalies down there. A number of whistleblowers have come forward and talked about three ancient extraterrestrial craft that are buried in the deep under Antarctica at different levels.
That's exciting, though, isn't it?
This will revolutionize the planet. You know, once this kind of information is confirmed and revealed, it'll be revolutionary. So far, what we have is Dr. Pete Peterson, who has talked about this in interviews he's done with David Wilcock, and Corey Good has also talked about these ships that are buried under the Antarctic ice. And, you know, the question everyone can ask, well, you know, where's the physical evidence? Well,
exactly. Hold on, Michael. Let's talk more about that and take some phone calls next hour on Coast to Coast AM.